The Forever War, Disc 6.
I was feeling pretty used up, but it was still kind of fascinating to watch the leg grow. White threads turned into blood vessels and nerves, first hanging a little slack, then moving into place as the musculature grew up around the metal bone. I got used to seeing it grow, so the sight never repelled me. But when Mary Gay came to visit, it was a jolt. She was ambulatory before the skin on her new arm had started to grow. Looked like a walking anatomy demonstration. I got over the shock, though, and she eventually came in for a few hours every day to play games, or trade gossip, or just sit and read, her arm slowly growing inside the plastic cast. I'd had skin for a week before they uncased the new leg and trundled the machine away. It was ugly as hell, hairless and dead white, stiff as a metal rod. But it worked, after a fashion. I could stand up and shuffle along. They transferred me to orthopedics for range and motion repatterning, a fancy new name for slow torture. They strap you into a machine that bends both the old and new legs simultaneously. The new one resists. Mary Gay was in a nearby section, having her arm twisted methodically. It must have been even worse on her. She looked gray and haggard every afternoon, when we met to go upstairs and sunbathe in the broken shade. As the days went by, the therapy became less like torture and more like strenuous exercise. We both began swimming for an hour or so every day, in the calm, pressor-guarded water off the beach. I still limped on land, but in the water, I could get around pretty well. The only real excitement we had on heaven, excitement to our combat-blunted sensibilities, was in that carefully guarded water. They have to turn off the pressor field for a split second every time a ship lands, otherwise it would just ricochet off over the ocean. Every now and then, an animal slips in, but the dangerous land animals are too slow to get through. Not so in the sea. The undisputed master of heaven's oceans is an ugly customer that the angels, in a fit of originality, named the shark. It could eat a stack of earth sharks for breakfast, though. The one that got in was an average-sized white shark who had been bumping around the edge of the pressor field for days, tormented by all that protein splashing around inside. Fortunately, there's a warning siren 2 minutes before the pressor is shut down, so nobody was in the water when he came streaking through. And streak through he did, almost beaching himself in the fury of his fruitless attack. He was 12 meters of flexible muscle, with a razor-sharp tail at one end and a collection of arm-length fangs at the other. His eyes, big yellow globes, were set on stalks more than a meter out from his head. His mouth was so wide, that open, a man could comfortably stand in it. Make an impressive photo for his heirs. They couldn't just turn off the pressor field and wait for the thing to swim away, so the recreation committee organized a hunting party. I wasn't too enthusiastic about offering myself up as an hors d'oeuvre to a giant fish, but Mary Gay had spearfished a lot as a kid growing up in Florida and was really excited by the prospect. I went along with the gag when I found out how they were doing it. Seemed safe enough. These sharks supposedly never attack people in boats. Two people who had more faith in fishermen's stories than I had gone out to the edge of the pressor field in a rowboat, armed only with a side of beef. They kicked the meat overboard, and the shark was there in a flash. This was the cue for us to step in and have our fun. There were 23 of us fools waiting on the beach with flippers, masks, breathers, and one spear each. The spears were pretty formidable, though. Jet-propelled, and with high explosive heads. We splashed in and swam in phalanx, underwater, toward the feeding creature. When it saw us, at first it didn't attack. It tried to hide its meal, presumably so that some of us wouldn't be able to sneak around and munch on it while the shark was dealing with the others. But every time he tried for the deep water, he'd bump into the pressor field. He was obviously getting pissed off. Finally, he just let go of the beef, whipped around, and charged. Great sport. He was the size of your finger one second, way down there at the other end of the field, then suddenly as big as the guy next to you, and closing fast. Maybe 10 of the spears hit him. Mine didn't, and they tore him to shreds. But even after an expert or lucky brain shot that took off the top of his head and one eye, even with half his flesh and entrails scattered in a bloody path behind him, he slammed into our line and clamped his jaws around a woman, grinding off both of her legs before it occurred to him to die. We carried her, barely alive, back to the beach, where an ambulance was waiting. They poured her full of blood surrogate and no shock, and rushed her to the hospital, where she survived to eventually go through the agony of growing new legs. I decided that I would leave the hunting of fish to other fish. Most of our stay at Threshold, once the therapy became bearable, was pleasant enough. No military discipline, lots of reading, and things to potter around with. But there was a pall over it, since it was obvious that we weren't out of the army, just pieces of broken equipment that they were fixing up to throw back into the fray. Mary Gay and I each had another 3 years to serve in our lieutenancies. But we did have 6 months of rest and recreation coming, once our new limbs were pronounced in good working order. Mary Gay was released 2 days before I was, but waited around for me. My back pay came to $892,746,012. Not in the form of bales of currency, fortunately. On Heaven, they used an electronic credit exchange. So I carried my fortune around in a little machine with a digital readout. To buy something, you punched in the vendor's credit number and the amount of purchase. The sum was automatically shuffled from your account to his. The machine was the size of a slender wallet and coded to your thumbprint. Heaven's economy was governed by the continual presence of thousands of resting, recreating millionaire soldiers. A modest snack would cost $100, a room for a night at least 10 times that. Since UNEF built and owned Heaven, this runaway inflation was pretty transparently a simple way of getting our accumulated pay back into the economic mainstream. We had fun, desperate fun. We rented a flyer and camping gear and went off for weeks exploring the planet. There were icy rivers to swim and lush jungles to crawl through, meadows and mountains and polar wastes and deserts. We could be totally protected from the environment by adjusting our individual pressor fields, sleep naked in a blizzard, or we could take nature straight. At Mary Gay's suggestion, the last thing we did before coming back to civilization was to climb a pinnacle in the desert, fasting for several days to heighten our sensibilities, or warp our perceptions, I'm still not sure, and sit back to back in the searing heat, contemplating the languid flux of life. Then off to the fleshpots. We toured every city on the planet, and each had its own particular charm. But we finally returned to Sky to spend the rest of our leave time. The rest of the planet was bargain basement compared to Sky. In the 4 weeks we were using the Airborne Pleasure Dome as our home base, Mary Gay and I each went through a good $500 million. We gambled, sometimes losing $1 million or more in a night, ate and drank the finest the planet had to offer, and sampled every service and product that wasn't too bizarre for our admittedly archaic tastes. We each had a personal servant, whose salary was rather more than that of a major general. Desperate fun, as I said. Unless the war changed radically, our chances of surviving the next 3 years were microscopic. We were remarkably healthy victims of a terminal disease, trying to cram a lifetime of sensation into a half of a year. We did have the consolation, not small, that however short the remainder of our lives would be, we would at least be together. For some reason, it never occurred to me that even that could be taken from us. We were enjoying a light lunch in the transparent first floor of Sky, watching the ocean glide by underneath us, when a messenger bustled in and gave us 2 envelopes, our orders. Mary Gay had been bumped to captain, and I to major, on the basis of our military records and tests we had taken at Threshold. I was a company commander, and she was a company's executive officer. But they weren't the same company. She was going to muster with a new company being formed right here on Heaven. I was going back to Stargate for indoctrination and education before taking command. For a long time, we couldn't say anything. "I'm going to protest," I said finally, weakly. "They can't make me a commander, into a commander." She was still struck dumb. This was not just a separation. Even if the war was over, and we left for Earth only a few minutes apart, in different ships, the geometry of the collapsar jump would pile up years between us. When the second one arrived on Earth, his partner would probably be a half century older, more probably dead. We sat there for some time, not touching the exquisite food, ignoring the beauty around us and beneath us, only conscious of each other and the 2 sheets of paper that separated us with a gulf as wide and real as death. We went back to Threshold. I protested, but my arguments were shrugged off. I tried to get Mary Gay assigned to my company as my exec. They said my personnel had all been allotted. I pointed out that most of them probably hadn't even been born yet. Nevertheless, allotted, they said. It would be almost a century, I said, before I even get to Stargate. They replied that Strike Force Command plans in terms of centuries, not in terms of people. We had a day and a night together. The less said about that, the better. It wasn't just losing a lover. Mary Gay and I were each other's only link to real life, the Earth of the 1980s and 90s, not the perverse grotesquerie we were supposedly fighting to preserve. When her shuttle took off, it was like a casket rattling down into a grave. I commandeered computer time and found out the orbital elements of her ship and its departure time. Found out I could watch her leave from our desert. I landed on the pinnacle where we had starved together, and a few hours before dawn, watched a new star appear over the western horizon, flare to brilliance and fade as it moved away, becoming just another star, then a dim star, and then nothing. I walked to the edge and looked down the sheer rock face to the dim, frozen rippling of dunes half a kilometer below. I sat with my feet dangling over the edge, thinking nothing, until the sun's oblique rays illuminated the dunes in a soft, tempting chiaroscuro of low relief. Twice I shifted my weight, as if to jump. When I didn't, it was not for fear of pain or loss. The pain would be only a bright spark, and the loss would be only the armies, and it would be their ultimate victory over me, having ruled my life for so long, to force an end to it, that much. I owed to the enemy. Major Mandela, 2458 to 3143 A.D. Chapter 1. What was that old experiment they told us about in high school biology? Take a flatworm and teach it how to swim through a maze, then mash it up and feed it to a stupid flatworm. And lo, the stupid flatworm would be able to swim the maze, too. I had a bad taste of Major General in my mouth. Actually, I suppose they had refined the technique since my high school days. With time dilation, that was about 450 years for research and development. At Stargate, my orders said I was to undergo indoctrination and education prior to taking command of my very own strike force, which was what they still called a company. For my education on Stargate, they didn't mince up major generals and serve them to me with hollandaise. They didn't feed me anything except glucose for 3 weeks. Glucose and electricity. They shaved every hair off my body, gave me a shot that turned me into a dish rag, attached dozens of electrodes to my head and body, immersed me in a tank of oxygenated fluorocarbon, and hooked me up to an ALSC. That's an Accelerated Life Situation Computer. It kept me busy. I guess it took the machine about 10 minutes to review everything I had learned previously about the martial, excuse the expression, arts. Then it started in on the new stuff. I learned the best way to use every weapon, from a rock to a Nova bomb. Not just intellectually. That's what all those electrodes were for. Cybernetically controlled negative feedback kinesthesia. I felt the weapons in my hands and watched my performance with them, and did it over and over until I did it right. The illusion of reality was total. I used a spear thrower with a band of Maasai warriors on a village raid, and when I looked down at my body, it was long and black. I relearned Ape from a cruel-looking man in foppish clothes in an 18th-century French courtyard. I sat quietly in a tree with a Sharps rifle and sniped at blue-uniformed men as they crawled across a muddy field toward Vicksburg. In 3 weeks, I killed several regiments of electronic ghosts. It seemed more like a year to me, but the ALSC does strange things to your sense of time. Learning to use useless exotic weapons was only a small part of the training. In fact, it was the relaxing part, because when I wasn't in kinesthesia, the machine kept my body totally inert and zapped my brain with 4 millennia's worth of military facts and theories, and I couldn't forget any of it. Not while I was in the tank. Want to know who Scipio Aemilianus was? I don't. Bright light of the Third Punic War. War is the province of danger, and therefore courage above all things is the first quality of a warrior, von Clausewitz maintained. And I'll never forget the poetry of the advance party minus normally moves in a column formation with the platoon headquarters leading, followed by a laser squad, the heavy weapons squad, and the remaining laser squad. The column relies on observation for its flank security, except when the terrain and visibility dictate the need for small security detachments to the flanks, in which case the advance party commander will detail 1 platoon sergeant, and so on. That's from Strike Force Command Small Unit Leader's Handbook. As if you could call something a handbook when it takes up to 2 whole microfiche cards, 2,000 pages. If you want to become a thoroughly eclectic expert in a subject that repels you, join UNIF and sign up for officer training. 119 people, and I was responsible for 118 of them. Counting myself, but not counting the Commodore, who could presumably take care of herself. I hadn't met any of my company during the 2 weeks of physical rehabilitation that followed the ALSC session. Before our first muster, I was supposed to report to the temporal orientation officer. I called for an appointment, and his clerk said the colonel would meet me at the Level 6 Officers Club after dinner. I went down to 6 early, thinking to eat dinner there, but they had nothing but snacks, so I munched on a fungus thing that vaguely resembled escargot and took the rest of my calories in the form of alcohol. Major Mandela? I'd been busily engaged in my 7th beer and hadn't seen the colonel approach. I started to rise, but he motioned for me to stay seated and dropped heavily into the chair opposite me.
"I'm in your debt," he said. "You saved me from at least half a boring evening."
He offered his hand.
"Jack Kynock at your service."
"Colonel?"
"Don't colonel me, and I won't major you. We old fossils have to keep our perspective, William."
"All right with me." He ordered a kind of drink I'd never heard of.
"Where to start? Last time you were on Earth was 2007, according to the records."
"That's right."
"Didn't like it much, did you?"
"No. Zombies, happy robots."
"Well, it got better. Then it got worse, thank you."
A private brought his drink, a bubbling concoction that was green at the bottom of the glass and lightened to chartreuse at the top. He sipped.
"Then they got better again, then worse, then, I don't know, cycles."
"What's it like now?"
"Well, I'm not really sure. Stacks of reports and such, but it's hard to filter out the propaganda. I haven't been back in almost 200 years. It was pretty bad then. Depending on what you like."
"What do you mean?"
"Oh, let me see. There was lots of excitement. Ever hear of the pacifist movement?"
"I don't think so."
The name's deceptive. Actually, it was a war, a guerrilla war. I thought I could give you name, rank, and serial number of every war from Troy on up."
He smiled.
"They must have missed one." "For good reason. It was run by veterans, survivors of Yod 38 and Aleph 40, I hear. They got discharged together and decided they could take on all of UNIF, Earthside. They got lots of support from the population."
"But didn't win."
"We're still here."
He swirled his drink, and the colors shifted.
"Actually, all I know is hearsay. Last time I got to Earth, the war was over, except for some sporadic sabotage. And it wasn't exactly a safe topic of conversation."
"It surprises me a little," I said. "Well, more than a little, that Earth's population would do anything at all against the government's wishes." He made a noncommittal sound.
"Least of all revolution. When we were there, you couldn't get anybody to say a damned thing against the UNIF, or any of the local governments, for that matter. They were conditioned from year to year to accept things as they were."
"Ah, that's a cyclic thing, too." He settled back in his chair.
"It's not a matter of technique. If they wanted to, Earth's government could have total control over every non-trivial thought and action of each citizen, from cradle to grave. They don't do it because it would be fatal, because there's a war on. Take your own case. Did you get any motivational conditioning while you were in the can?"
I thought for a moment. If I did, I wouldn't necessarily know about it.
That's true. Partially true. But take my word for it, they left that part of your brain alone. Any change in your attitude toward UNIF or the war, or war in general, comes only from new knowledge. Nobody's fiddled with your basic motivations. And you should know why.
Names, dates, figures rattled down through the maze of new knowledge. Tet 17, Sed 21, Aleph 14, the Laszlo Emergency Commission Report, June 2106.
Right, and by extension, your own experience on Aleph 1. Robots don't make good soldiers.
They would, I said. Up to the 21st century, behavioral conditioning would have been the answer to a general's dream. Make up an army with all the best features of the SS, the Praetorian Guard, the Golden Horde, Mosby's Raiders, the Green Berets.
He laughed over his glass. Then put that army up against a squad of men in modern fighting suits. It'd be over in a couple of minutes.
So long as each man in the squad kept his head about him and just fought like hell to stay alive. The generation of soldiers that had precipitated the Laszlo reports had been conditioned from birth to conform to somebody's vision of the ideal fighting man. They worked beautifully as a team, totally bloodthirsty, placing no great importance on personal survival. And the Torrens cut them to ribbons. The Torrens also fought with no regard for self, but they were better at it, and there were always more of them. Kynok took a drink and watched the colors.
"I've seen your psych profile," he said, "both before you got here and after your session in the can. It's essentially the same, before and after."
"That's reassuring." I signaled for another beer.
"Maybe it shouldn't be."
"What, it says I won't make a good officer? I told them that from the beginning. I'm no leader."
"Right, in a way. Wrong, in a way. Want to know what that profile says?"
I shrugged. "Classified, isn't it?"
"Yes," he said. "But you're a major now. You can pull the profile of anybody in your command."
"I don't suppose it has any big surprises." But I was a little curious. What animal isn't fascinated by a mirror?
"No, it says you're a pacifist. A failed one at that, which gives you a mild neurosis, which you handle by transferring the burden of guilt to the army."
The fresh beer was so cold it hurt my teeth.
"No surprises yet. And as far as being a leader, you do have a certain potential, but it would be along the lines of a teacher or a minister. You would have to lead from empathy, compassion. You have the desire to impose your ideas on other people, but not your will, which means, you're right, you'll make one hell of a bad officer, unless you shape up."
I had to laugh. UNIF must have known all of this when they ordered me to officer training.
"There are other parameters," he said. "For instance, you're adaptable, reasonably intelligent, analytical, and you're one of the 11 people who's lived through the whole war."
Surviving is a virtue in a private. Couldn't resist it. "But an officer should provide gallant example, go down with the ship, stride the parapet as if unafraid." He harumphed at that.
"Not when you're 1,000 light years from your replacement."
"It doesn't add up, though. Why would they haul me all the way from heaven to take a chance on my shaping up, when probably a third of the people here on Stargate are better officer material? God, the military mind."
"I suspect the bureaucratic mind at least had something to do with it. You have an embarrassing amount of seniority to be a foot soldier."
"That's all time dilation. I've only been in 3 campaigns.
Immaterial. Besides, that's 2.5 more than the average soldier survives. The propaganda boys will probably make you into some kind of a folk hero.
Folk hero. I sipped at the beer. Where is John Wayne now that we really need him?
John Wayne? He shook his head. I never went in the can, you know. I'm no expert at military history.
Forget it.
Kynock finished his drink and asked the private to get him, I swear to God, a rum Antares. Well, I'm supposed to be your temporal orientation officer. What do you want to know about the present? What passes for the present?
Still on my mind. You've never been in the can?
No, combat officers only. The computer facilities and energy you go through in 3 weeks would keep the Earth running for several days. Too expensive for us desk warmers.
Your decorations say you're combat.
Honorary. I was.
The rum Antares was a tall, slender glass with a little ice floating at the top, filled with pale amber liquid. At the bottom was a bright red globule about the size of a thumbnail. Crimson filaments waved up from it. What's that red stuff?
Cinnamon. Oh, some ester with cinnamon in it. Quite good. Want a taste?
No, I'll stick to beer, thanks.
Down at level 1, the library machine has a temporal orientation file that my staff updates every day. You can go to it for specific questions. Mainly, I want to prepare you for meeting your strike force.
What, they're all cyborgs? Clones? He laughed.
No, it's illegal to clone humans. The main problem is with, you're heterosexual.
Oh, that's no problem. I'm tolerant.
Yes, your profile shows that you think you're tolerant, but that's not the problem exactly.
Oh. I knew what he was going to say. Not the details, but the substance.
Only emotionally stable people are drafted into UNIF. I know this is hard for you to accept, but heterosexuality is considered an emotional dysfunction. Relatively easy to cure.
If they think they're going to cure me,
relax, you're too old.
He took a delicate sip.
It won't be as hard to get along with them as you might.
Wait, you mean nobody, everybody in my company is homosexual? But me?
William, everybody on Earth is homosexual, except for 1,000 or so veterans and incurables.
Ah. What could I say? Seems like a drastic way to solve the population problem.
Perhaps. It does work, though. Earth's population is stable at just under 1 billion. When one person dies or goes off-planet, another is quickened.
Not born.
Born, yes, but not the old-fashioned way. Your old term for it was test tube babies. But, of course, they don't use a test tube.
Well, that's something.
Part of every creche is an artificial womb that takes care of a person the first 8 or 10 months after quickening. What you would call birth takes place over a period of days. It isn't the sudden, drastic event that it used to be.
Oh, brave new world, I thought. No birth trauma. 1 billion perfectly adjusted homosexuals.
Perfectly adjusted by present-day Earth standards. You and I might find them a little odd.
That's an understatement. I drank off the rest of my beer. Yourself, you, are you homosexual?
Oh, no,
he said. I relaxed.
Actually, though, I'm not hetero anymore either.
He slapped his hip, and it made an odd sound.
Got wounded, and it turned out that I had a rare disorder of the lymphatic system. Can't regenerate. Nothing but metal and plastic from the waist down. To use your word, I'm a cyborg.
Far out, as my mother used to say.
Oh, Private, I called to the waiter. Bring me one of those Antares things. Sitting here in a bar with an asexual cyborg, who is probably the only other normal person on the whole goddamn planet. Make it a double, please.
Chapter 2. They looked normal enough, filing into the lecture hall where we held our first muster the next day, rather young and a little stiff. Most of them had only been out of the creche for 7 or 8 years. The creche was a controlled, isolated environment to which only a few specialists, pediatricians and teachers mostly, had access. When a person leaves the creche at age 12 or 13, he chooses a first name, his last name having been taken from the donor parent with the higher genetic rating, and is legally a probationary adult, with schooling about equivalent to what I had after my first year of college. Most of them go on to more specialized education, but some are assigned a job and go right to work. They're observed very closely, and anyone who shows any signs of sociopathy, such as heterosexual leanings, is sent away to a correctional facility. He's either cured or kept there for the rest of his life. Everyone is drafted into UNIF at the age of 20. Most people work at a desk for 5 years and are discharged. A few lucky souls, about 1 in 8,000, are invited to volunteer for combat training. Refusing is sociopathic, even though it means signing up for an extra 5 years, and your chance of surviving the 10 years is so small as to be negligible. Nobody ever had. Your best chance is to have the war end before your 10 subjective years of service are up. Hope that time dilation puts many years between each of your battles. Since you can figure on going into battle roughly once every subjective year, and since an average of 34% survive each battle, it's easy to compute your chances of being able to fight it out for 10 years. It comes to about 0.02% of 1%. Or to put it another way, get an old-fashioned six-shooter and play Russian roulette with 4 of the 6 chambers loaded. If you can do it 10 times in a row without decorating the opposite wall, congratulations, you're a civilian. There being some 60,000 combat soldiers in UNIF, you could expect about 1.2 of them to survive for 10 years. I didn't seriously plan on being the lucky one, even though I was halfway there. How many of these young soldiers filing into the auditorium knew they were doomed? I tried to match faces up with the dossiers I'd been scanning all morning, but it was hard. They'd all been selected through the same battery of stringent parameters, and they looked remarkably alike. Tall, but not too tall, muscular, but not heavy, intelligent, but not in a brooding way. And Earth was much more racially homogeneous than it had been in my century. Most of them looked vaguely Polynesian. Only 2 of them, Kayabanda and Lynn, seemed pure representatives of racial types. I wondered whether the others gave them a hard time. Most of the women were achingly handsome, but I was in no position to be critical. I'd been celibate for over a year, ever since saying goodbye to Mary Gay, back on Heaven. I wondered if one of them might have a trace of atavism, or might humor her commander's eccentricity. It is absolutely forbidden for an officer to form sexual liaison with his subordinates. Such a warm way of putting it. Violation of this regulation is punishable by attachment of all funds and reduction to the rank of private, or if the relationship interferes with a unit's combat efficiency, summary execution. If all of UNEF's regulations could be broken so casually and consistently as that one was, it would be a very easy-going army. But not one of the boys appealed to me. How they'd look after another year, I wasn't sure.
Tanch, hut!
That was Lieutenant Hillebo. It was a credit to my new reflexes that I didn't jump to my feet. Everybody in the auditorium snapped to.
My name is Lieutenant Hillebo, and I am your field officer.
That used to be Field First Sergeant. A good sign that an army has been around too long is that it starts getting top-heavy with officers. Hillebo came on like a real hard-ass professional soldier, probably shouted orders at the mirror every morning while she was shaving. But I'd seen her profile and knew that she'd only been in action once, and only for a couple of minutes at that. Lost an arm and a leg, and was commissioned, same as me, as a result of the tests they give at the regeneration clinic. Hell, maybe she had been a very pleasant person before going through that trauma. It was bad enough just having one limb regrown. She was giving them the usual first sergeant pep talk, stern but fair. Don't waste my time with little things. Use the chain of command. Most problems can be solved at the fifth echelon. It made me wish I'd had more time to talk with her earlier. Strike Force Command had really rushed us into this first muster. We were scheduled to board ship the next day, and I'd only had a few words with my officers. Not enough, because it was becoming clear that Hillebo and I had rather disparate philosophies about how to run a company. It was true that running it was her job. I only commanded. But she was setting up a potential good-guy-bad-guy situation, using the chain of command to so isolate herself from the men and women under her. I had planned not to be quite so aloof, setting aside every hour every other day, when any soldier could come to me directly with grievances or suggestions, without permission from his superiors. We had both been given the same information during our 3 weeks in the can. It was interesting that we'd arrived at such different conclusions about leadership. This open-door policy, for instance, had shown good results in modern armies in Australia and America, and it seemed especially appropriate to our situation, in which everybody would be cooped up for months or even years at a time. We'd used the system on the Sangre e Victoria, the last starship to which I'd been attached, and it had seemed to keep tensions down. She had them at ease while delivering this organizational harangue. Pretty soon she'd call them to attention and introduce me. What would I talk about? I'd planned just to say a few predictable words and explain my open-door policy, then turn them over to Commodore Antipol, who would say something about the Masaryk too. But I'd better put off my explanation until after I'd had a long talk with Hillebo. In fact, it would be best if she were the one to introduce the policy to the men and women, so it wouldn't look like the two of us were at loggerheads. My executive officer, Captain Moore, saved me. He came rushing through a side door. He was always rushing, a pudgy meteor, threw a quick salute and handed me an envelope that contained our combat orders. I had a quick whispered conference with the Commodore, and she agreed that it wouldn't do any harm to tell them where we were going, even though the rank and file technically didn't have the need to know. One thing we didn't have to worry about in this war was enemy agents. With a good coat of paint, a Tauren might be able to disguise himself as an ambulatory mushroom, bound to raise suspicions. Hillebo had called them to attention and was dutifully telling them what a good commander I was going to be, that I'd been in the war from the beginning, and if they intended to survive through their enlistment, they had better follow my example,
She didn't mention that I was a mediocre soldier with a talent for getting missed, nor that I'd resigned from the army at the earliest opportunity and only got back in because conditions on Earth were so intolerable. "Thank you, Lieutenant." I took her place at the podium. "At ease." I unfolded the single sheet that had our orders and held it up. "I have some good news and some bad news." What had been a joke 5 centuries before was now just a statement of fact. "These are our combat orders for the Sade 138 campaign. The good news is that we probably won't be fighting, not immediately. The bad news is that we're going to be a target." They stirred a little bit at that, but nobody said anything, or took his eyes off me. Good discipline. Or maybe just fatalism. I didn't know how realistic a picture they had of their future. Their lack of a future, that is. "What we are ordered to do is to find the largest portal planet orbiting the Sade 138 Collapsar and build a base there, then stay at the base until we are relieved. That will be 2 or 3 years, probably. During that time, we will almost certainly be attacked. As most of you probably know, Strike Force Command has uncovered a pattern in the enemy's movements from Collapsar to Collapsar. They hope eventually to trace this complex pattern back through time and space and find the Tauren's home planet. For the present, they can only send out intercepting forces to hamper the enemy's expansion. In a large perspective, this is what we're ordered to do. We'll be one of several dozen strike forces employed in these blocking maneuvers on the enemy's frontier. I won't be able to stress often enough or hard enough how important this mission is. If UNIF can keep the enemy from expanding, we may be able to envelop him and win the war. Preferably before we're all dead meat. One thing I want to be clear. We may be attacked the day we land, or we may simply occupy the planet for 10 years and come on home. Fat chance. Whatever happens, every one of us will stay in the best fighting trim all the time. In transit, we will maintain a regular program of calisthenics as well as a review of our training, especially construction techniques. We have to set up the base and its defense facilities in the shortest possible time. God, I was beginning to sound like an officer. Any questions? There were none. Then I'd like to introduce Commodore Antipol. Commodore? The Commodore didn't try to hide her boredom as she outlined, to this room full of ground pounders, the characteristics and capabilities of Masaryk II. I had learned most of what she was saying through the can's force feeding, but the last thing she said caught my attention. Sada 138 will be the most distant Collapsar men have gone to. It isn't even in the galaxy proper, but rather is part of the large Magellanic Cloud, some 150,000 light-years distant. Our voyage will require 4 Collapsar jumps and will last some 4 months, subjective. Maneuvering into Collapsar insertion will put us about 300 years behind Stargate's calendar by the time we reach Sada 138. And another 700 years gone, if I live to return. Not that it would make that much difference. Mary Gay was as good as dead, and there wasn't another person alive who meant anything to me. As the Major said, you mustn't let these figures lull you into complacency. The enemy is also headed for Sada 138. We may all get there the same day. The mathematics of the situation is complicated, but take our word for it. It's going to be a close race. Major, do you have anything more for them? I started to rise. Well, Tench Hut! Hillebo shouted. Had to learn to expect that. Only that I'd like to meet with my senior officers, echelon 4 and above, for a few minutes,
Platoon sergeants, you're responsible for getting your troops to staging Area 67 at 0400 tomorrow morning. Your time's your own until then. Dismissed. I invited the five officers up to my billet and brought out a bottle of real French brandy. It had cost 2 months' pay, but what else could I do with the money? Invest it? I passed around glasses, but Alcever, the doctor, demurred. Instead, she broke a little capsule under her nose and inhaled deeply, then tried without too much success to mask her euphoric expression. First, let's get down to one basic personnel problem, I said, pouring. Do all of you know that I'm not homosexual? Mixed chorus of yes, sirs, and no, sirs. Do you think this is going to complicate my situation as commander, as far as the rank and file?
Sir, I don't...
Moore began. No need for honorifics, I said. Not in this closed circle. I was a private 4 years ago in my own time frame. When there aren't any troops around, I'm just Mandela or William. I had a feeling that was a mistake, even as I was saying it. Go on.
Well, William, he continued, it might have been a problem 100 years ago. You know how people felt then.
Actually, I don't. All I know about the period from the 21st century to the present is military history.
Oh. Well, it was, how to say it?
His hands fluttered.
It was a crime,
Alcever said laconically.
That was when the Eugenics Council was first getting people used to the idea of universal homosex.
Eugenics Council?
Part of UNIF, only has authority on Earth.
She took a deep sniff at the empty capsule.
The idea was to keep people from making babies the biological way. Because A, people showed a regrettable lack of sense in choosing their genetic partner, and B, the council saw that racial differences had an unnecessarily divisive effect on humanity. With total control over births, they could make everybody the same race in a few generations.
I didn't know they had gone quite that far, but I suppose it was logical. You approve as a doctor?
As a doctor, I'm not sure.
She took another capsule from her pocket and rolled it between thumb and forefinger, staring at nothing, or something the rest of us couldn't see.
In a way, it makes my job simpler. A lot of diseases simply no longer exist. But I don't think they know as much about genetics as they think they do. It's not an exact science. They could be doing something very wrong, and the results wouldn't show up for centuries.
She cracked the capsule under her nose and took two deep breaths.
As a woman, though, I'm all in favor of it.
Killebeau and Rusk nodded vigorously. Not having to go through childbirth?
That's part of it.
She crossed her eyes comically, looking at the capsule, gave it a final sniff.
Mostly, though, it's not having to have a man inside me. You understand? It's disgusting.
Moore laughed.
If you haven't tried it, Diana, don't...
Oh, shut up.
She threw the empty capsule at him playfully. But it's perfectly natural, I protested.
So is swinging through trees, digging for roots with a blunt stick. Progress, my good major, progress.
Anyway, Moore said,
it was only a crime for a short period. Then it was considered a... Oh, curable dysfunction,
Alcever said.
Thank you. And now, well, it's so rare. I doubt that any of the men and women have any strong feelings about it, one way or the other. Just an eccentricity, Diana said magnanimously. Not as if you ate babies. That's right, Mandela, Hillebo said. I don't feel any differently toward you because of it.
I'm glad. That was just great. It was dawning on me that I had not the slightest idea of how to conduct myself socially. So much of my normal behavior was based on a complex, unspoken code of sexual etiquette. Was I supposed to treat the men like women and vice versa? Or treat everybody like brothers and sisters? It was all very confusing. I finished off my glass and set it down.
Well, thanks for your reassurances. That was mainly what I wanted to ask you about. I'm sure you all have things to do, goodbyes and such. Don't let me hold you prisoner. They all wandered off except for Charlie Moore. He and I decided to go on a monumental binge, trying to hit every bar and officers' club in the sector. We managed 12, and probably could have hit them all, but I decided to get a few hours' sleep before the next day's muster. The one time Charlie made a pass at me, he was very polite about it. I hoped my refusal was also polite, but figured I'd be getting lots of practice.
Chapter 3 UNIF's first starships had been possessed of a kind of spidery, delicate beauty, but with various technological improvements, structural strength became more important than conserving mass. One of the old ships would have folded up like an accordion if you tried a 25G maneuver. And that was reflected in the design. Stolid, heavy, functional-looking. The only decoration was the name Masaryk II, stenciled in dull blue letters across the obsidian hull. Our shuttle drifted over the name on its way to the loading bay, and there was a crew of tiny men and women doing maintenance on the hull. With them as a reference, we could see that the letters were a good 100 meters tall. The ship was over a kilometer long, 1,036.5 meters, my latent memory said, and about a third that wide, 319.4 meters. That didn't mean there was going to be plenty of elbow room. In its belly, the ship held 6 large tachyon-drive fighters and 50 robot drones. The infantry was tucked off in a corner. War is the province of friction, Chuck von Clausewitz said. I had a feeling we were going to put him to the test. We had about 6 hours before going into the acceleration tank. I dropped my kit in the tiny billet that would be my home for the next 20 months and went off to explore. Charlie had beaten me to the lounge and to the privilege of being first to evaluate the quality of Masaryk II's coffee. "Rhinoceros bile," he said. "At least it isn't soya," I said, taking a first cautious sip. Decided I might be longing for soya in a week. The officer's lounge was a cubicle about 3 meters by 4, metal floor and walls, with a coffee machine and a library readout, 6 hard chairs and a table with a typer on it. Jolly place, isn't it? He idly punched up a general index on the library machine. Lots of military theory. That's good. Refresh our memories. Sign up for officer training? Me? No. Orders. At least you had an excuse. He slapped the on-off button and watched the green spot dwindle. I signed up. They didn't tell me it'd feel like this. Yeah. He wasn't talking about any subtle problem, burden of responsibility or anything. They say it wears off a little at a time. All of that information they force into you, a constant silent whispering.
Ah, there you are.
Hillebo came through the door and exchanged greetings with us. She gave the room a quick survey, and it was obvious that the Spartan arrangements met with her approval.
Will you be wanting to address the company before we go into the acceleration tanks?
No, I don't see why that would be necessary.
I almost said desirable. The art of chastising subordinates is a delicate art. I could see that I'd have to keep reminding Hillebo that she wasn't in charge. Or I could just switch insignia with her. Let her experience the joys of command.
You could please round up all platoon leaders and go over the immersion sequence with them. Eventually, we'll be doing speed drills. But for now, I think the troops could use a few hours' rest.
If they were as hungover as their commander.
Yes, sir.
She turned and left. A little miffed because what I'd asked her to do should properly have been a job for Ryland or Rusk. Charlie eased his pudgy self into one of the hard chairs and sighed.
20 months on this greasy machine. With her. Shit.
Well, if you're nice to me, I won't billet the two of you together.
All right. I'm your slave forever. Starting, next Friday.
He peered into his cup and decided against drinking the dregs.
Seriously, she's going to be a problem. What are you going to do with her?
I don't know. Charlie was being insubordinate, too, of course. But he was my XO and out of the chain of command. Besides, I had to have one friend. Maybe she'll mellow once we're underway.
Sure.
Technically, we were already underway, crawling toward the Stargate Collapsar at 1G, but that was only for the convenience of the crew. It's hard to batten down the hatches in freefall. The trip wouldn't really start until we were in the tanks. The lounge was too depressing, so Charlie and I used the remaining hours of mobility to explore the ship. The bridge looked like any other computer facility. They had dispensed with the luxury of view screens. We stood at a respectful distance while Antipole and her officers went through a last series of checks before climbing into the tanks and leaving our destiny to the machines. Actually, there was a porthole, a thick plastic bubble, in the navigation room forward. Lieutenant Williams wasn't busy, the pre-insertion part of his job being fully automated, so he was glad to show us around. He tapped the porthole with a fingernail.
Hope we don't have to use this trip.
How so? Charlie said.
We only use it if we get lost.
If the insertion angle was off by a thousandth of a radian, we were liable to wind up on the other side of the galaxy.
We can get a rough idea of our position by analyzing the spectra of the brightest stars.
Thumbprints. Identify 3 and we can triangulate.
Then find the nearest collapsar and get back on the rack, I said. That's the problem. Sada 138 is the only collapsar we know of in the Magellanic Clouds. We know of it only because of captured enemy data. Even if we could find another collapsar, assuming we got lost in the cloud, we wouldn't know how to insert.
That's great.
It's not as though we'd be actually lost, he said with a rather wicked expression. We could zip up in the tanks, aim for Earth, and blast away at full power. We'd get there in about 3 months, ship time.
Sure, I said, but 150,000 years in the future. At 25 Gs, you get to 9/10 the speed of light in less than a month. From then on, you're in the arms of St. Albert.
Well, that is a drawback, he said. But at least we'd find out who'd won the war.
It made you wonder how many soldiers had gotten out of the war in just that way. There were 42 strike forces, lost somewhere and unaccounted for. It was possible that all of them were crawling through normal space at near light speed and would show up at Earth or Stargate one by one over the centuries. A convenient way to go AWOL, since once you were out of the chain of collapsar jumps, you'd be practically impossible to track down. Unfortunately, your jump sequence was pre-programmed by Strike Force Command, The human navigator only came into the picture if a miscalculation slipped you into the wrong wormhole, and you popped out in some random part of space. Charlie and I went on to inspect the gym, which was big enough for about a dozen people at a time. I asked him to make up a roster so that everyone could work out for an hour each day when we were out of the tanks. The mess area was only a little larger than the gym. Even with four staggered shifts, the meals would be shoulder-to-shoulder affairs, and the enlisted men and women's lounge was even more depressing than the officers. I was going to have a real morale problem on my hands long before the 20 months were up. The armorer's bay was as large as the gym, mess hall and both lounges put together. It had to be, because of the great variety of infantry weapons that had evolved over the centuries. The basic weapon was still the fighting suit, though it was much more sophisticated than that first model I had been squeezed into just before the Aleph Null campaign. Lieutenant Ryland, the armory officer, was supervising his four subordinates, one from each platoon, who were doing a last-minute check of weapon storage. Probably the most important job on the whole ship, when you contemplate what could happen to all those tons of explosives and radioactives under 25 Gs. I returned his perfunctory salute. "Everything going all right, Lieutenant?" "Yes, sir, except for those damned swords." "For use in the stasis field." "No way we can orient them that they won't be bent. Just hope they don't break." I couldn't begin to understand the principles behind the stasis field, the gap between present-day physics and my master's degree in the same subject was as long as the time that separated Galileo and Einstein. But I knew the effects. Nothing could move at greater than 16.3 meters per second inside the field, which was a hemispherical, in space, spherical, volume, about 50 meters in radius. Inside, there was no such thing as electromagnetic radiation, no electricity, no magnetism, no light. From inside your suit, you could see your surroundings in ghostly monochrome, which phenomenon was glibly explained to me as being due to phase transference of quasi-energy leaking through from an adjacent tachyon reality. So much phlogiston to me. The result of it, though, was to make all conventional weapons of warfare useless. Even a Nova bomb was just an inert lump inside the field, and any creature, Terran or Tauran, caught inside the field without the proper insulation would die in a fraction of a second. At first, it looked as though we had come upon the ultimate weapon. There were five engagements where whole Tauran bases were wiped out without any human ground casualties. All you had to do was carry the field to the enemy. Four husky soldiers could handle it in Earth gravity, and watch them die as they slipped in through the field's opaque wall. The people carrying the generator were invulnerable, except for the short periods when they might have to turn the thing off to get their bearings. The sixth time the field was used, though, the Taurans were ready for it. They wore protective suits and were armed with sharp spears with which they could breach the suits of the generator carriers. From then on, the carriers were armed. Only three other such battles had been reported, although a dozen strike forces had gone out with the stasis field. The others were still fighting, or en route, or had been totally defeated. There was no way to tell, unless they came back. And they weren't encouraged to come back if Taurans were still in control of their real estate. Supposedly that constituted desertion under fire, which meant execution for all officers, although rumor had it that they were simply brain-wiped, imprinted, and sent back into the fray. "Will we be using the stasis field, sir?" Ryland asked. "Probably. Not at first, not unless the Taurans are already there. I don't relish the thought of living in a suit day in and day out. Neither did I relish the thought of using sword, spear, throwing knife, no matter how many electronic illusions I'd sent to Valhalla with them. Checked my watch. Well, we'd better get on down to the tanks, Captain, make sure everything's squared away. We had about 2 hours before the insertion sequence would start.
This ends Disc 6.